This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
It's been almost 3 years since Alec Murdaugh was found guilty of murdering his wife and son. I know, hard to believe, a verdict that seemed too close, seemed to close the book on the Southern dynasty built on power and deceit. But it didn't end there. Now, three final filings sit before the South Carolina Supreme Court, and they tell two very different stories about justice. The state says this is simple. The evidence was overwhelming. The kennel video put him there. His lies sealed it. Case closed. Go away. Make another miniseries. The defense says the opposite, that their trial itself was tainted before it ever began, that the clerk of court, Becky Hill, influenced jurors. The key DNA went untested. Experts were pressured, and the process itself collapsed under the weight of misconduct. So the question now isn't whether Alec Murdaugh is guilty, it's whether the system that convicted him still deserves our trust. And depending on that decision, that's what could lead us to a courtroom where the arguments of the actual case could be brought up again. Right now, the argument is about the system itself, not the actual act of murder. Joining us is former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis to break down what this appeal really means legally, ethically, and for every person who still believes the courts should get it right, even when the whole world already has picked a side. Eric, welcome. In a case like this that lands in front of a state Supreme Court, what are the justices weighing here? The facts or the integrity of how those facts were handled?
Well, like you alluded to, Tony, the Supreme Court has a big responsibility ahead of it because it needs to look at, of course, the significance of the case itself, the facts of the case itself. But also there are larger concerns. There are larger concerns about the system. And you know, sometimes even when we have an unpopular defendant, what safeguards must be honored and observed such that we can have that systemic integrity, even when we think the jury might have got it right? Was there some sort of error that could impugn the system and diminish our reliance on it going forward, and have the justices sort of balance all of those things?
And there's a lot of angles, and there's you know, three key places that the defense of Alec Murdaugh is going at here. We're going to get into all of those shortly. You know, from a dual perspective here, you have the prosecutor, then you have a defense, and on both ends. What's your first instinct in reading these filings that we have here? Confidence in the verdict or concern about the mechanics of all of this?
Right. I mean, there's truly a tension between confidence in the verdict and confidence in our system. And with this appeal, can we have both? Is that something that can be analyzed and with which the public can have faith going forward? And that's really at the crux of it. You know, I've reviewed the pleadings, and for what it's worth, I think Murdaugh makes a compelling argument. Certainly there are countervailing considerations on the other side. But yeah, it's really that tension between systemic issues and the facts of this horrific double homicide.
Eric, what kind of a challenge is there when your client is also an attorney? Are there challenges that come up, especially in something like this? Is it nice to have that second brain on file for you, or is that a hindrance at times?
You know, yes and no, Stacey, that can be a blessing and a curse. You know, they have legal insights sometimes that they see avenues that might not have been apparent to the attorney themselves, because they're the client. They know what happened. On the other side, sometimes they can become a little overbearing. They can sometimes influence legal decisions from their own sort of biased perspective, whereas a more objective attorney representing the lawyer might say, hey, look, you know, from an outsider's perspective, you shouldn't do that, bro. And I think that could have come up in Murdaugh's decision to testify in this case. So it can be difficult when you have a lawyer as a client and you want to provide strategic guidance and they want to provide strategic guidance. And
have sometimes you ever that had guidance one? Is a conflict. Have you ever had it? Yeah. How do you manage that? I mean, do you take them aside and go, enough, dude?
you know, there's an old saying, I think it's attributed to Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, and it's something to the effect of, you know, a person who represents themselves has a fool for a client. And really the principle is that you're not unbiased. If you're a party to the case, you have different prejudices and sympathies and leanings. And the attorney's job representing you is to sort of disabuse you of those and say, hey, this is the objective legal analysis as I see it. And those two perspectives can really come into conflict.
Have we ever seen a case where, I mean, we've seen obviously people self-represent themselves, but it's usually people who are not attorneys. You would think you would see more in the line of people who actually are attorneys, or maybe you wouldn't because they have enough sense to know that's a horrible idea, even if you're extremely educated on the topic at hand.
Oh, totally. Yeah. The clients who are attorneys, often they know, you know, for me, for example, if I was going through some legal dispute that was outside of my practice area, you better believe I'm enlisting somebody who's a specialist in that. I don't know how to do probate law or whatever. Sure. And, you know, as the client themselves can become so emotionally invested in, you know, a particular fact of the case, like, hey, I don't believe I was doing anything wrong, right? I was doing something to help somebody out. And perhaps that's not material legally, but it's hard to detach them from some of those positions to which they're married, which could be to their legal detriment.
How much do you think Alex steered this case when we look back on it, or the courtroom and his attorneys? When we look back on it, you know, obviously it's all, you know, hindsight now, it's all history, seeing, you know, how the testimony went, who testified when, who said what. How do you think that went? Do you think that was more, you know, Jim and Dick that were running the show, or was it was Alec just as involved, if not more heavily involved in being a third captain of the ship, if you will?
I have to imagine that Alec tried to exert significant control over how his defense was presented and how they handled the case from that side. You know, like I said, his decision to testify, although there were arguably compelling reasons for him to do that, there are also a number of pitfalls, and I think he's stepped at a number of times. And so you got to wonder, hey, did his attorneys tell him, not sure you should testify here? And did he sort of overbear their decision by saying, hey, I'm a lawyer too. I know what I'm getting into, you know, shut up and let me handle this. I don't know that that's how it went, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were such interactions.
I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. We probably talked about it a year or two ago, but just to refresh, you know, my memory and everybody's memory, now that we're all kind of into this case again and the new special is out and all that, when Alec went to the stand and took the stand for himself in his snot-ridden testimony,
oh, God.
That was something.
It was so triggering.
It was something. When we look back on this, and he changed his story on the stand at that moment in time. For those playing along at home, he had denied being at the kennels forever, all the way up until that point, all the way through trial. Like, they had been arguing on his behalf that he was not at the kennels. Then suddenly, when Alec decides to go up and testify, boom, he drops a bombshell on everybody and says, I lied. I was at the kennels. Didn't say he killed anybody, but he lied. And then once he started telling that lie, oh, what a web we weave, or something he said. And it was, well, I started lying, so I had to keep lying. Obviously, the man is a pathological liar. Do you think that was part of the strategy all along? Or do you think that was a conversation the night before with Jim and Dick going, I think tomorrow I'm going to testify and I'm going to completely change my story publicly?
Oh, I think absolutely that the defense team had met pretrial about the possibility that Murdoch might want to testify, that he might have to testify just based on how the trial was going. So certainly those discussions were had. But yeah, there's a lot of recalibration as the trial's going on. And you know, like you said, in that 11th hour, the night before, you're having those discussion with the client and you're saying, hey, what's this going to look like? What risk do we need to try and control for? And that was something they couldn't deny, that he was there, because there is that video evidence that contradicts the statements he made to police and everybody else for months and months.
Yeah, I mean, and at that moment in time, How do you think his attorneys advised him at that moment? Do you think they said, go ahead, go up there, change your story? You've already been proven to be a liar about everything else. You're adding now a lie to the murder case. You're adding a lie about the very key moment where you should or should not be. And you're now going to go and expose this. Do you think they encouraged him to do that? Or was that an Alec move of he's just going to go and do what he's going to do?
I can't help but wonder if there was perhaps some overconfidence on both sides, on behalf of the defense attorneys and on behalf of Alec, to say, hey, look, this isn't just some layperson, you know, accountant or bartender or something who's going to get up there and talk. This is a seasoned attorney who could probably tailor his testimony in a compelling way. And even though there is this glaring issue of that makes it look like he's a huge liar, him being at the vicinity when this happened, I think maybe both sides thought he would be able to sort of sidestep and tiptoe around it and do a song and dance up there. And I think he was singing a little too much, dancing a little too much. And the jury was certainly rubbed the wrong way and by a lot of his testimony.
And we're going to get into some of this stuff here with the appeal, but I want to just keep it on the trial itself and just kind of rehashing of some of that for a few moments. When we look back on other aspects of this case, on his personality, and we've seen so many cases where people act certain ways after a crime is committed. Sometimes, you know, there's a certain level of guilt that seems to emanate off of them. Sometimes there's a level of coldness that is there. And then sometimes it's hard to tell what's going on. When you look at him from a human perspective and the grief that he did appear to have all the way back from the kennel video to pretty much anybody interacting with him for the days and weeks after Maggie and Paul were shot, to him in the courtroom and his testimony, take the verdict out of it, take everything you know out of it. How, if you didn't know the case and the story, does he read like someone who's lying, that is lying about being involved in the murder of his family? Or does he read like someone who is grieving the death and he doesn't really know what's going on? Or maybe he does, but he's not the one who pulled the trigger.
You know, he certainly reads like a chameleon, like someone who knows how to keep up public appearances, who's savvy, who's sophisticated, who can present in a compelling way. He probably had to do that as an attorney for years, and that's one of the reasons he was so successful. But on the inside, it seems like there was some serious, tumultuous stuff going on. There was the drug addiction. There was his financial ruin, which was happening, which it appears he was kind of in denial about that for years. And so it's just a conflict between what we're seeing on the outside and all of the chaos that likely was going on the inside. And so when a person has those sort of dual components, it's hard to tell whether they're being straight. Sometimes it's hard for them to tell whether they're being straight.
Yeah, I still struggle with that with him, you know, on the emotional end of it when I look at it, because I don't know. At the end of the day, I don't know. Is he a horrible guy? Did he do horrible things financially? Without a doubt. Was he able to lie straight face to, you know, people who are disabled, you know, people who lost their loved ones and steal their money? Yeah, that takes quite a monster to be able to do those sort of things. But at the end of the day, it was for insulating and maintaining his family. Then the idea that he's going to take them out, that's where we get to the familial side. And that's obviously what Creighton Waters argued in court, was that he took out his family basically because he didn't want to face their wrath or the shame that came along with basically Alec's mask falling and everyone seeing him for who he is, a thief, a crook, a liar. Everything that he pretended that he was against was actually who he actually was. And then did he take out his family to alleviate himself of that shame and to then create a distraction from all of that hoopla that was about to erupt? But at the end, I just don't know. Go ahead, Stacey.
Tony, couldn't you also say that maybe in some twisted, sick way, he wanted to spare them?
Yeah, I mean, you do see that. You see that with narcissists, where they're going to twist it. I mean, I've seen it where, okay, well, I will remove myself from this person's life if that's what's best for them. And they play the martyr. I mean, oftentimes it's not murder, but it's abandonment that you'll see that'll take place. And they'll spin it in a way that somehow, in their mind, looks like it's some sort of grace they're giving the world, when it's really just, it's more convenient for them because they don't want to deal with it. I mean, there's a lot of ways that it could be twisted around, and I can see it from both perspectives, but damn, he's a good chameleon. I mean, there's some bad liars out there, and his testimony was filled with a lot of snot, but it was hard to tell sometimes if there might have been tears going on there. I don't know. I mean, where do you sit on it, Eric? Like, where does your gut tell you? Where are you personally feeling about Alec Murdaugh these days on whether or not he did pull the trigger on this or had some involvement or none at all?
You know, I'm no Alec Murdaugh apologist, and I'm not a huge sympathizer of him as a person, but I've always had questions about this case. You mentioned the motive, and Alec Murdaugh's team brings that up in their appeal, actually. They say, hey, this motive is totally implausible. It doesn't really make sense. He had all these financial issues going on, so he kills his wife and kid who had nothing to do with it. How does, you know, that doesn't necessarily solve the financial issues. It doesn't, there's kind of a logical disconnect between, my bank accounts suck, therefore I'm going to shoot my wife and kid. Like, that didn't check out to me personally.
What shame.
I was skeptical of that.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it, though. It's about shame. I mean, that's shame, and mixed with a narcissistic personality, a disorder, and then you also put the opioids in there. And right. The opioids are what kind of make me go, maybe that's what pulled him over. Like, take the opioids out of the equation, and I don't know that I would think that he's the one who did it. But when you add that in, and just there doesn't seem to be a logical other suspect here at all. I mean, we've never, and that's another thing. We've never even heard of any other suspect. We've never even heard a story of, other than like, well, people were mad at them because of the boat crash. Yes, of course they were. I'm surprised, you know, that nothing else had happened. But oftentimes those things settle and people, you know, get on with their lives, and there's going to be that anger there forever. But for all these years after the boat crash, because it wasn't immediate, this was several years after that boat crash, that this takes place. But again, no other alternative suspects or even ideas on who it would be. And none even presented by Alec either, which I also found interesting in the trial. Sometimes you're going to get, you know, and obviously it's going to depend what they're allowed to introduce or not in terms of a third party suspect. But there was like not even an inkling of it off the record, off of the courts from the attorneys when they're trying to play, you know, media games and give their spin. Were you surprised by that at all?
Totally. I mean, somebody did this. It was a person. And if it wasn't Alec Murdaugh, you know, you would think that he would have at least a sense as to what directions we can start looking at in terms of specific people. And in terms of the admissibility of alternative suspect defenses, usually you need to have a direct, non-speculative connection to an alternative suspect, an actual person. You can't just go in there and be like, could have been a lot of people. Some people didn't like them or whatever. Usually you need to be like, hey, it could have been this person for these reasons. This was the connection. He was in the state at the time. He had this motive. He had the opportunity. He owned firearms, whatever. You have to get to that next level in terms of alternative suspect. They never got there.
They never even attempt to get there.
No.
And is, I mean, like, we've seen cases where they're really, really reaching for shit. Like, you know, there's some crazy cases that we've seen in the last year, and I won't go into them all because I'll piss people off, but where it's like, that's quite a reach. But it's amazing what can sometimes be admitted. If you were Alec's attorneys, would you be looking for something, anything? Or do you think maybe that they did? These aren't moronic attorneys. They're good attorneys. Yeah. They have track records. They are well-respected. It's not Jackie Fulford, the Tom Petty lookalike that's working out of the crematorium. So I'm going to guess they had to maybe explore that option. But if you have nowhere to go, I guess you have nowhere to go.
Without question, they explored it. And even Harpootlian, one of his defense attorneys, I believe, is a state senator out in South Carolina. So these are high profile premier attorneys. I wonder what dead ends they may have hit and that precluded them from sort of launching a more compelling alternative suspect defense. Because I think the jury was like, it's a human being did this. And the person on trial, there's video of him being in the vicinity, you know, minutes before this likely happened. If it wasn't him, give us something. Show it. Give us something to hang our hats on. And there was no such rung provided by defense.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, sometimes if you're not going to want to try and present something out there, if you know that a very big hole can be punched into it, and that might just be it. They knew that there was going to be holes punched into anything that they were going to come up with. Before we move into talking more about the motion here and the arguments, the Becky Hill, the sled issues, all that, Stacey, in the comments, is there anything on this area of the case where we're talking about the crime itself, Alec Murdaugh, and this half? That's of note.
Yeah, really good comment from the last 24. It says, I'm real interested in them recently opening back up the Stephen Smith case. They thought his son could have been linked to, in my opinion, if he was Alec Knows and or had a hand in the cover-up. So that link coming out in our comment section. Yeah. A lot of comments about the snot.
Yeah. and the Stephen Smith case is a fascinating one. I personally do not think Buster had anything to do with it. I feel horrible for that kid. I think he's a victim to the circumstances of that family. There just never has been any sort of evidence that seemed to have come to light that makes any sense of it. Was there knowledge of, you know, in the good old boy club of who maybe, you know, would have had it out likely for a gay teen in that area of the country at that moment in time? I would think maybe. I would think there might be some rumblings and inklings about it. But, you know, because there's, you know, hatred runs deep in those parts on issues like that. And, you know, could there be knowledge? Maybe. But I don't know. I don't see a connection with Buster on that. And I feel bad for all the shit that he's had to go through as a victim of his family. But that's a very compelling case. It still sits with zero answers on it as well. Where do you think that could be headed in the future, Eric?
You know, I think that if there was enough there to raise a material issue in Murdaugh's trial itself, that it would have been used as a ground for appeal. I reviewed the pleadings. I didn't personally see that in there. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of reminds me of the Koberger case where he was sort of angling towards, hey, someone else could have done this. Okay, well, who? And his defense couldn't find and identify an actual alternative suspect. And I think that that sort of played out here where there was just not enough evidence to tie that thing as horrible as it was to the Murdaugh case itself. And without it being included in the appeal, I think it's going to be dead in the water at this point.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate because that family wants answers, and you know anybody wants answers on that
one. Well, they deserve answers. I mean, that's the bigger thing.
Yeah, I wonder if we're ever going to get them, or if it's one of those that's, you know, people are so tight-lipped on some of those things there that we're never going to get it.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.